I want to talk this morning about faith, what it is and what it's not, and I want to talk about faith development, growing in faith. People have studied this, and I'll cite some, and how you can grow in faith, how you can become more faithful, how you can try to be, live more faithfully. Well, that's one of this big topic, but I want to scratch the surface, and I want to use two. I want to kind of try to juggle both the language we're familiar with in kind of the West and liberal Protestant theology of the culture, I guess, and also Buddhist language. We read in the book of Hebrews, in the Hebrew scriptures, in the Christian scriptures, we read that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. The assurance of things hoped for, the convictions of things not seen. As such, it's a way of knowing and understanding distinct from our other way of knowing and understanding, or science. Some see faith and science at loggerheads, or, in the words of the late popular biologist Stephen Jay Gould, as non-overlapping magisteria. But basically, they're, highbrow Harvard guy. But the, so non-overlapping magisteria, science, this other way of knowing, faith, or just at loggerheads, fighting. How could you believe in science and have faith? But I see them as harmonious and complementary paths to truth. There's a tendency in the culture, and on TV anyway, in pop culture, to equate faith with doctrine. It leads to arguments about doctrine, and it gets us nowhere, it seems to me. Especially as you use, why would we be, trying to convince or, teach, improve each other about that kind of thing? Whether faith is to be connected to deity, faith in some kind of higher power, or not, its essence, it seems to me, lies in trusting ourselves enough to discover the deepest truths on which we can rely. To trust ourselves enough to figure out, to know that we can find our way. That's faith. That we have the kind of resources internally and our head, our heart, our allies, our support system to carry on. It'll be okay. We can do that. That's faith. In the language of the original Buddhist texts, Pali, the word usually translated as faith, confidence, or trust, is sada, meaning to place the heart upon. To have faith is to offer one's heart, or to give of one's heart. In Pali, faith is a verb, an action, as it is in Latin and in Hebrew. In other words, faith isn't a singular state. It's not a thing you can acquire or have or don't have. It's something you do. It's a willingness to take the next step, to see the unforeseen future as an adventure, and to launch into that venture. Virgil's classic, the Aeneid, Greek Roman epic poetry, it's an epic journey of faith. The hero, Aeneas, escapes the sack of Troy, having no idea where he's going, on his way to do one thing. He's blown by storm and fortune, ends up doing something else. Then, or think of 1001 Arabian Nights, Sinbad the sailor. He's a similar kind of karma. I mean, their ships are battered, they're plundered, they're attacked. But they're guided all along by a faint yet compelling sense of mission. And they repeatedly face the unknown and just when things start to look good, it all collapses in the face of doom, and at the last minute, an escape route is revealed, one after another, just high and low, and high and low. And they're about to be devoured by some kind of gorgon, and they turn, oh, and there's a magic carpet, and off they go. And I mean, it's just like one event after another, constantly changing, none of it predictable. Still, the heroes plug away. Abraham Lincoln, a real-life hero, was once asked what the deepest truth he knew was. His reply, "This too shall pass." He realized that everything is in the process of flux, forever changing, evolving, transitioning through space and time, that it's the essence of reality, of life. Solid as they seem, even the Sierra Nevada are slowly crumbling and will disappear one day. Our internal states change too. Implacable heartache gives way to new love. Physical distress subsides. Excitement wanes. No matter what's happening, when we recognize the inevitability of change, ordinary, even oppressive dimensions of our lives open up and kind of become alive with prospect. Things may improve or they may get worse, but they're bound to be different tomorrow. This is the first step. It's the beginning of faith. Accepting the inevitability of change. The second step is going forward anyway, uncertain how events will unfold, but risking that they might well turn out better and willing to find out either way. I think Martin Luther King said, faith is starting up the stairs when you can't see to the landing. Going. Building on the work of developmental psychologist Jean Piaget, I mean, you know, said, study of cognitive development, Lawrence Kohlberg, who studied moral development, theologian James Fowler taught at Emory University, the Chandler School of Theology, for years and is still connected with them, and a religious educator, John Westerhoff, both write about this progression or faith development. How we grow in understanding and the practice of faith, from innocent faith to literal faith to critical faith to what they call an integrative faith, whether there really are stages or not. Fowler and Westerhoff help us get a handle on this idea of faith as a verb, as a journey, not a thing, not a corpus of you're supposed to buy into. Now, I mentioned the reading came from Susan Salzberg, and she describes her whole faith journey in this book, Faith, in the Language of Buddhism. And when I'm talking about Buddhism, I'm drawing a lot on Sharon Salzberg. She grew up in a secular Jewish household and discovered Buddhism as a young woman. Initially, she was dazzled by her meditation teachers, and she gobbled up their every word. Now, she describes this from a later point of view in a later place in her evolving faith journey as bright faith. She just, Buddhism, man, they got every answer and the people are all enlightened and it's so groovy. And she gobbled up every word, bright faith. It was healthy in that it mobilized her energy to let go of the convenient and familiar and stake out, like start out, like her poem that you read, the Mary Oliver, just, you know, to save yourself and off you go. You leave Buffalo or Cleveland or however, wherever, and you head in an unknown direction. Now, bright faith is good enough, but it can begin to resemble blind faith. Unthinking devotion to a teacher or teaching, and some people really get stuck there. For Salzberg, bright faith is just the beginning. She sees that as a step in this kind of progression of faith. And it's not about putting aside our discriminating intelligence, this faith journey she's describing, But it's about, the first step, this bright faith, is about putting aside cynicism and apathy. Quit just going through, just start taking seriously ethical and life, your mortality, and is there something going on that maybe I should be paying more attention to in terms of my soul? So, this is true of a lot of people. I think a lot of 12-step people find that they're in a kind of a chaotic, highly cynical place, and then if it's killing them, they recognize that and they get into the program, and it's healthy. But you can grab it too literally and you know, beat up anybody who doesn't believe it. And you know, Freudians are like that, communists can be like that. I mean, they grab a soul-saving ideology or theology or what have you, and then they adopt it literally, and it can be strangling. But it's a first step, that bright faith. Don't let it be strangling. That's what she asks us to do. Consider Francis S. Collins. Francis Collins is an American physician and geneticist, and he was the leader, really, of the Human Genome Project, and he's currently director of the National Institute of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. No matter how much, I'm reading from Dr. Collins, no matter how much science describes the temporal sequence of sound waves in a Bach concerto or a mass in D minor, he writes, there's something more there that lifts the spirit. It's the realization that these kinds of spiritual experiences can't be dismissed as epiphenomenal froth on the subject, on the surface of a cold, hard universe. That to him is how he described the religious experience of hearing beautiful music. Just, how'd that be? You know, I've had that experience in concerts, but also at a wonderful play, you know, Shakespeare, in particular Greek tragedy. The physicist Werner Heisenberg, though, but let's stick with music. He recounts just such a wonderful experience right after World War I, and he's at a gathering of young people trying to establish some order and a new vision in the wake of the World War I detritus. And he finds himself involved in countless meetings, a lot of blather, a lot of posturing, and the absence of any unifying center was affecting him viscerally. He was getting very upset. He writes, thus the hours ticked by while more speeches were delivered, more disputes were born. The shadows of the courtyard grew longer, and finally the hot day gave way to a slate dusk and a moonlit night. The talk was still going on when quite suddenly a young violinist appeared on the balcony of the courtyard. There was a hush. High above us, he struck up the first great D minor chord of Bach's Chaconne. All at once, and with utter certainty, I had found my link with the center. The clear phrases of the Chaconne touched me like a cool wind breaking through the mist and revealing the towering structures beyond. There had always been a path to the central order in the language of music, in philosophy, and in religion. Today, no less than in Plato's day, and in Bach's, that I knew now from my own experience. I'm the founder of quantum mechanics. Testing what we've heard and read from others, be they gurus or scientists, is necessary if we want to turn this initial enthusiasm into something deeper, long-lasting and soul-sustaining. We have to ask questions, find our voices, explore and verify through our own experience what we've heard and seen from others outside of ourselves. This is actually the Protestant principle. Every person, every man, the priesthood of all believers, the priesthood of all people, the priesthood of everyone, is a Protestant principle. You don't take it from somebody else. Where are you in relation to all this? How do you work it through? When we fail to question what we're putting our faith in, fail to test it against our own experience, this bright faith becomes blind faith. And we have to be able to sort things out and to doubt and to wonder. And that Unitarian Universalism has held all along. It's, leave your thinking caps on, as my third grade teacher used to say, when you come to church here. Because here's the thing about faith. Faith and doubt, they're not at war. They imply each other. They're mutually arising phenomena. They're mutually arising things. They happen together. You can't have faith without doubt or doubt without faith. They imply each other. They're like two sides of the same coin. Cherish your doubts, wrote the Unitarian minister Robert T. Weston. For doubt is the attendant of truth. It's the other side of truth. It's the acid which eats away the false. Let no one fear for the truth that doubt would consume it. For doubt is a testing of belief. The truth stands boldly and unafraid. It's not shaken by the testing. For truth, if it be truth, arises from each testing stronger and more secure. And in this, Robert Weston is echoing Jefferson and back to John Milton. But truth, don't be afraid of the truth. Truth stands clear. People see it when they see it. Beliefs which cannot be questioned are based on fear. And wherever fear dominates, our sense of possibilities starts collapsing. And with fewer and fewer possibilities, we freeze. The opposite of faith is not doubt. It's inertia, doing nothing. People are apparently becoming radicalized on the internet or otherwise just going nuts and shooting a bunch of people, and now it's almost become commonplace. People were deeply shaken now. I know I was only 5 years ago next month when they first heard about the massacre of over 20 students at Virginia Tech. Professor Liviu Librescu, a Holocaust survivor, was shot and killed in that massacre while holding off the gunman at the entrance of his classroom while telling students to escape out the windows. Professor Librescu exemplifies, it seems to me, what it means to be a person of faith. 76-year-old engineering professor, having lived under both Nazi and communist tyranny, acted immediately without a thought to his own personal safety. Things might get worse, and they might get better, but fear only freezes us and prevents us from acting wisely and compassionately, or even at all, on behalf of others and ourselves. The English word courage is the same root as cœur for French, which is a word for heart. Heart. Bravery is not banishing fear. No fear. You see that those decals on the people's cars, trucks. It's not having no fear or banishing fear. It's acting in spite of fear. And faith is just the same. To be faithful isn't to banish anxiety that things might not turn out the way we hope. It's making choices about what we can do, what we can affect, fully aware that a whole lot is beyond our control every day, all around us. The gift of faith, writes Susan Salzberg, allows us to act guided by a more holistic vision of life, with all its mutability and effervescence, dislocations and uneasiness and unruliness. It's easy to lose touch with a holistic vision, which is another way of saying, I think, to lose touch of our sense as a part of the interconnected web and integrated into that part and a real part and an emotionally conscious, awake part sometimes. But it's easy to lose touch with that, and then we freeze. We go into despair. We've been nuked, as one of my mentor ministers, Paul Sawyer, used to say. We've been nuked. A woman who lived through the Hiroshima bombing, described her dislocation. When the bomb dropped, We all became separate human beings. Utter isolation and dislocation. Some people, some of us, in the midst of crisis, can feel devastated in situations far less horrendous than an atomic bomb. The Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl writes that when we're in despair, whatever the cause, we feel devastated and alone. We feel completely separate and cut off. The shooter, it turns out, at Virginia Tech, it's not clear, as he became isolated and in just this very sad and lonely and awful way. And meanwhile, we've got teenage jihadists who are longing to connect to something, anything bigger than themselves, and they become tied up in something of a mayhem and destructive making, and even worse, or seems to me completely worse. We're part of a web, whether we're aware of it or not. The physicist John Stuart Bell theorized that particles that were once connected when separated would still behave as if connected even at a distance. Another physicist, Alan Aspect, later proved Bell's theorem by separating photons and measuring their spin. No matter how distant the photons became, when the spin of one was measured, its partner simultaneously showed the opposite complementary spin. The correlation was instantaneous and faster than the speed of light across vast distances. When I contemplate interconnectedness on a scale like that, it blows my mind. And I marvel, I stand in awe. But it also simultaneously makes me sick, really sick. I mean, literally sick, to think about the environmental degradation that we are creating despite this recognition at times of great insight and personal peak experience, I don't know, where you feel so connected, and yet then you look at what we're doing to the earth and just pulling it heading for oblivion. Deforestation, pollution, mismanagement, and it affects biodiversity, migratory patterns, now even climate. Now the good news is, so I mean you have to always say, the good news is that because of our interconnectedness, we can do collectively and individually a lot, and if we do make a difference, we can make a huge difference. The immediate result, and then there's this thing about, well, maybe you can't, you know, listen to, you know, TV, and it all comes down to 5 votes versus 4 on the Supreme Court over there, 60 votes to override a filibuster, and I worked on the Hill, and I know that, and I know that's true, but it's not just the immediate results to our efforts that are that value, fully value any action. There's other values. Equally important is the quality of our intention and the skillfulness of our actions, and they can make an incredible difference, and they grow in faith. Think of Professor Lubescu. He not only saved lives, he became an inspiration to many people, including me, maybe now you. The theologian Paul Tillich defines faith as alignment with our ultimate concern, the values to which we're most devoted, and at the core of what we hold most dear. An ultimate concern is not anything facile, but it's the touchstone at the heart of hearts in our life. For many Unitarian Universalists, justice serves as an ultimate concern. UU Bernice Johnson Reagan, a singer-songwriter with Sweet Honey in the Rock, was a civil rights activist in the 60s, desegregating public facilities in her native Georgia. Recalling the danger of those days, she explains, "Now I sit back and look at some of the things we did and say, what in the world came over us? But death had nothing to do with what we were doing. If somebody shot us, we would be dead. And when people died, we cried and we went to funerals and we went and did the next thing the next day, because it really was beyond life and death. It was really like, sometimes you know what you're supposed to be doing, And when you know what you're supposed to be doing, it's somebody else's job to kill you. Unwavering faith in justice enabled Bernice and her fellow activists to carry on in spite of their fear and uncertainty. They continue to inspire today. Excuse me. For many UUs, faith in the laws of nature is their ultimate concern. Seeds regenerating after forest fires, rivers flowing to the sea, renewal following decay. It's reported that many Hiroshima survivors in the wake of the bomb doubted that grass, trees, flowers, that any of that would ever grow again in their world. But grass, trees, and flowers did grow again. And many survivors recalling those days say that only after seeing for themselves that natural law still prevailed did they have the faith to go on. The return of spring confirms faith for many people over the world. For others, growing in their capacity to love is their ultimate concern. As Martin Luther King said, that tell them that I learned how to love. Suzuki Roshi, author of the Buddhist classic Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, writes, even if the sun were to rise in the west, the bodhisattva has only one way. That one way for bodhisattvas is dedicating one's life to the benefit of all beings. Whatever one's ultimate concern, whatever your ultimate concern, the outcome of our efforts is always uncertain. But one thing is never uncertain. Whether we know success or failure, wealth or subsistence, acclaim or disregard, we can be inspired by our sense of purpose in all our choices. In the midst of this often tasteless and sometimes vulgar presidential clamoring, it's become almost routine mass slayings. I'm reminded of something my former grandmother-in-law, a coal miner's wife, once told me. Never go out the door angry at someone. You never know what day will be your last or that other person's. Any day could be the last day of our life. Living in faith means living that day, living this day, dedicated to what we most believe in, unwilling to be frozen by fear. So may it be. Shalom and Amen.